We're really excited to have Craig Mayberry here today. He's a lecturer at the Bainbridge Graduate Institute, which is a fantastic institute over on Bainbridge Island. Looks at sustainability and business. He also is a teacher and lecturer around several universities in the Pacific Northwest. He's a PhD student in the Resource Management Environmental Studies program at the University of British Columbia. And his dissertation looked at the impact of leadership in culture on the success of socially entrepreneurial organizations. And he's going to talk today about solving water issues through social entrepreneurship, which social entrepreneurship is really the hot topic. And so I'm so happy that you're here to speak about it today. That let's offer a warm welcome to Craig Mayberry.
Well, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. Can everybody hear me in the back? Okay. I tend to have a little bit of a loud voice, so I shouldn't have too much trouble. Just to talk a little bit more about my background here, because I think it's important in terms of what I'm going to talk to and why I am passionate about social entrepreneurship. I have an undergrad degree in economics, went on to get my MBA in finance, and went to work for a couple of large corporations. I worked for Chrysler Corporation back in Detroit, and then I went to work for Intel Corporation in California and then eventually in Portland. So I had an opportunity to experience and kind of see how large corporations work and saw some of the good side and a lot of the downside to these large organizations. Well, towards the end of my work at Intel, I had an opportunity to do a research project for the CFO looking at different ways to organize the finance function, and actually Intel in general. Intel has become, and now is very large, very bureaucratic. It wasn't working very effectively. The culture had changed dramatically. People were no longer enjoying their jobs as much anymore. It kind of set me in motion and thinking about this topic of, so how do you take and structure large organizations? I kind of realized there are some ways to do it, but the way you do it is actually through its smallness. You have to figure out how to. We talked a lot about enterprises, which is the equivalent of entrepreneurship in large corporations. I left Intel, had a couple of small businesses for a while, and decided what I really want to do is teach. So went and applied to the University of British Columbia. The Resource Management Environmental Studies program there is a multidisciplinary degree. I can take classes from anywhere. My dissertation committee is primarily made out of people out of the School of Business. So my background and focus is on business and in particular organizational behavior. But through all of this, I've concluded that, and quite honestly, I don't have a real strong belief that large corporations are going to solve many of the environmental and social problems. I'm not a big believer that government's going to solve them either. So what I concluded is one of the best ways that we may be able to do this is through social entrepreneurship. So that's through, you know, that's kind of the biased lens around which I look at this subject. What I want to talk to you today is about, you know, one is really defining what it is, because social entrepreneurship is a very new topic. It is not really a discipline. It's kind of barely a topic in many instances. And we're just in this, you know, from an academic standpoint, we're just in this phase where we're still trying to define what it is. So if you look at most of the academic research around social entrepreneurship, it tends to be very definitional in nature. So there's still a lot about what it really is, why it even exists. So we'll spend most of the time talking about those couple of things. We'll then try to apply it into the world of water and how do we solve water issues. And then we'll finish up with some challenges and next steps and Q&As. So why the latest craze? If you look back, one is social entrepreneurship in reality, or as I'm defining it, or as many define it, has actually been around for a while. David Bornstein wrote a wonderful book on social entrepreneurs. He went through and case studied a bunch of organizations that he considered social entrepreneurs. We'll talk about some of those today. But he even mentioned Florence Nightingale as a social entrepreneur. Florence Nightingale went, fundamentally changed the way medical services were delivered during the war, and even back within the city of London, made dramatic changes in medical care. Okay, this was an early example of social entrepreneurship. Since the 90s, this has really started to catch on, particularly in academics. So we're now seeing many academic institutions now are setting up Centers of Social Entrepreneurship. University of Calgary is one that set one up a couple of years ago. University of Colorado has one. I know even the University of Washington Business School and the Entrepreneurship Center here at University of Washington is doing some work on social entrepreneurship. It's a growing trend in academics, which is one of the reasons why I like it and I'm interested in it. It's fun to be on the forefront versus kind of on the back end of stuff. The other thing is you're starting to see now various organizations, Oshaka is one of them, that is starting now to basically provide the VC equivalent, you know, the venture capital equivalent to social entrepreneurs. You have a local organization here in Seattle, the Social Ventures Partners, where they're actually going out and providing capital to social entrepreneurs to be able to start businesses. And in some cases, they're for-profit businesses, in some cases, they are not-for-profit. So, it's very new. The research has been very theoretical and pretty convoluted. So, as we go through this talk, I mean, you can see some of this come through. I'm not going to be able to give you an exact definition of what social entrepreneurship is, because we don't really know. There's a lot of gray areas. You can take a look in social, you can take a look at organizations and say, well, is that a social enterprise or not? Right? And it's right now, it's still kind of in the gut feel stage. It's hard to say definitively yes and definitively no. So the other thing is, you know, I suspect most of you are coming from the natural sciences background. Okay, I'm coming from a social science background. Okay, the research and academics and stuff, there's a lot of differences. So if through the course of this you struggle with some of the things that I'm talking about, in large measure it may be because I'm coming at it from more of a social science background. I'm looking at stuff like sociology, organizational theory, those sorts of things is the lens by which I look through stuff. And I know in my work at Institute of Resource Management Environmental Studies at UBC, which most of the people tend to be natural sciences, every time I've gotten up and tried to present to a bunch of natural scientists, I get actually cremated because I'm looking through things through a very different lens and we don't necessarily talk the same language or have the same inherent assumptions. So, in talking about social entrepreneurship, is first of all, we need to kind of define what entrepreneurship is. And this leads to part of the difficulty with social entrepreneurship is even entrepreneurship isn't particularly well defined, and even as a topic or as a discipline, it's still pretty convoluted. So, there's a couple of different definitions that have been used in the academic literature. One is basically around new organizations. We tend to think somebody goes out and starts a new business, and we would say, that's very entrepreneurial of you. Okay, you're going out creating this new organization. Or you're creating, you know, in the large corporate world, what we were doing, we were starting enterprises, what some of the literature would call as intrapreneuring, is creating new organizations within existing organizations. So you take a large organization like University of Washington, and you go off and set up a new center that's supposed to pursue some new academic research or some new research, that would be called a new enterprise. Also has entrepreneurial overtones to it. So that's really more on how you create, you know, new organizations and new ideas. The other side of it is entrepreneurs are generally thought of as people who take and accumulate resources in new and creative and innovative ways. So the third one, the process by which individuals pursue opportunities without regard to the resources they control. Okay, this is the creative side of entrepreneurship. So you have kind of two different ways. You can have it's a new organization, or we're going to take and we're going to find very creative, innovative solutions to new problems. We're going to take existing resources and people and we're going to combine them in new ways to get new results out of them. And then the last one there, the discovery and exploitation of profitable opportunities for private wealth and may have some consequences on social wealth as well. So this is the, you know, kind of the traditional, you know, entrepreneurs are greedy capitalists. They're in it to make money. Okay. What I want to focus in on, what I'm going to use as my definition of entrepreneurship today is really focus in primarily around that third one. It's about the accumulation of resources. It's about coming up with creative solutions. Okay? Just because somebody goes out and starts a new nonprofit organization doesn't necessarily mean they're an entrepreneur, under my definition. What I want to see is I want to see creative and innovative solutions. Now, the other part, when we tend to think about entrepreneurs, is we tend to think about some of the traits that they have. Okay, entrepreneurs, if you look through the literature, you find a bunch of different traits that entrepreneurs get defined as. They tend to be risk-taking. They tend to have a lot of self-efficacy. They're very confident in what they do. They are passionate, tenacious, have an ability to communicate a vision. You go back and you look at Hewlett and Packard and the creation of HP, or Bill Gates and the creation of Microsoft, or some of the founders at Intel, right? That were under great odds and used all of these skills. They took tremendous risks, leaving jobs, trying to do things on a shoestring. Hewlett and Packard started a business in their garage with, I think it was like $5,000 or $10,000, kind of a minimal amount of money. And they were just, they kind of, whatever obstacles came, they figured out creative ways to be able to overcome those obstacles. And through their passion and tenacity, through their confidence, they're able to come up with very radical solutions to problems that existed at that point in time. Okay. So that's the other part of entrepreneurship I'm interested in. I want people, not somebody who kind of goes off and, I liken it to, you go off and you start a new restaurant. Right. Yes, you're creating a new organization, you're being entrepreneurial, but you're not really doing anything creative. And, kind of a lot of people start new restaurants. It's not real. I mean, it takes some of this, but we're talking about significant amounts of these sorts of traits is what we're looking for from an entrepreneurship standpoint. So we're looking for creativity, and we're looking that the entrepreneur has demonstrated high amounts of these sorts of traits. Okay, so that's on the entrepreneurial side. So now when we get into social entrepreneurship, what we're doing is we're taking that entrepreneur, we're taking the creative solutions that gathers resources, that demonstrates high amount of these entrepreneurial tendencies, and we're combining that with a very strong social mission. You have people who are passionate about solving social and environmental issues. Okay, they tend to, they're driven by mission instead of money. And the social entrepreneurship literature talks about this a lot. Now, there's absolutely, not that I can find a whole lot of research to substantiate it, but there's a lot of conversations about people being motivated more by mission instead of the accumulation of wealth. Okay, so you're combining those entrepreneurial traits with these strong social traits, and what you end up with is change agents. People who are out there trying to fix problems not currently solved by the current institutions out there, whether they be current businesses, current government, current nonprofits, or social sector. These are people who are fundamentally making changes in the way that they operate. So let me give you a kind of one example, which many of you may have heard of, Grameen Bank. So Grameen Bank in India, I believe it was the 70s or 80s, it was a while ago. A gentleman there had an idea saying, we've got these people who are in the rural villages that are incredibly poor. The India banks at the time would not provide any sort of funding or capital. They were seen as too risky. They were seen there was no way they could make money. The banks were completely ignoring them. The current institutions were ignoring these people. So they came up and said, well, what if we go out and we start doing microlending? We'll provide small dollar amounts, $5, $10, $15, $20, which for them, for us is not a whole lot of money, but for them was enough to be able to go out and start their own businesses on a very small scale. And we will go into communities and we'll provide loans to a bunch of people and they'll kind of work as a community or cooperative and they'll ensure the payments and get repaid. And we'll figure out ways to be able to provide capital so these people can be lifted out of poverty. Well, over the last couple of decades, they've provided huge amounts of loans and done a tremendous amount to be able to solve some of the poverty issues in India. A very creative solution, took immense amount of risk trying to figure out how to accomplish this, and has now created an industry, micro-lending industry, that's now starting to propagate throughout the world. Okay, significant social change has occurred because of that one idea. Okay, so that's, on a very grand scale, that is what I'm talking about when I talk about social entrepreneurship and being able to fundamentally change society. So then the next question becomes, so why do these exist? Okay, why, these are significant issues, they're not getting solved. Why are they not getting solved? Well, if you look at it, there's three large sectors or kind of groups of institutions that are responsible for certain parts of our society. You've got the business sector, you've got the government sector, and then you've got the social sector. Well, the problem with each of these is, and for different reasons, each one of them doesn't necessarily do all that they're supposed to do. Okay, for those of you who have economics, and I teach economics at Whatcom Community College, we talk a lot about market failures. Markets are at times very efficient, very effective at accomplishing what they need to do. But at times they are very inefficient and they actually do fail. You have firms that are inefficient, you have externalities where the cost associated, think of a good example here, pollution. Pollution is an example of externality. The cost of polluting is not borne by the company, it's borne by society, and therefore it's not inherently baked into the operating cost of the company, therefore they don't price for it, therefore it never gets captured by the person who is buying the goods or service. So those externalities create problems. It's a place where the business sector fails. You have flawed pricing mechanisms, and you have imperfectly distributed information. Okay. Markets work really well if you've got perfect information and you have no externalities and you have perfectly efficient firms. But in many cases, that's not the case. Grameen Bank is an example of this. Okay. The banks at the time, due to some of these issues, flawed pricing mechanisms and imperfectly distributed information, were not providing small dollar amount loans to the poor. So a social entrepreneur came in there, saw that business sector failure and said, okay, we're going to find a creative way of being able to do it. The second one, you've got the government sector. Governments are large bureaucracies, and having worked in a large bureaucracy, and frankly, in my mind, there's very little difference between Intel and Chrysler and governments. For the person actually working in the organization, how decisions are made, etc., there's not a whole lot of difference. Government sector bureaucratic failures, large organizations, they don't change easily. Okay, they're very resistant to change. They change very slowly. Well, the world has gotten far more complex. The social and environmental issues have gotten far more complex. And the government sector has not been able to adapt their processes and how they do things to be able to meet that rising complexity. Therefore, governments have failed on many instances to be able to come in and solve social and environmental issues that really probably are their responsibility. They haven't been able to do it. And usually what ends up happening is when government does try to come in and do something, then they tend to set up another bureaucracy to be able to go off and do that. And what that bureaucracy ends up doing is just trying to insulate themselves and protect them from everybody else in the organization, and now becomes part of the larger bureaucratic problem and actually ends up creating more problems than they solve. Okay, so those are the challenges, right? That's the hard part of dealing with government. So it tends to not necessarily do a great job of solving some of the problems out there. So then you've got the social sector. This is basically the nonprofits, the non-governmental organizations, those type of organizations. What we're seeing is the nonprofit sector is becoming much more competitive. And what I mean by this is the number of nonprofits out there is growing a lot faster than people's donations. If you look at from a foundation, which tends to be one of the large contributors to nonprofits, in excluding inflation, kind of in real dollar terms, the grants given by large foundations has not really changed much in about 5 years, even though we've seen significant numbers of nonprofits going up. And on the individual level, people are contributing more, but again, not at a rate that is slower than the number of new nonprofits that are created. That's creating funding problems for nonprofits. Okay, they're not able to get and accumulate as many resources as they would like to be able to accomplish their mission, which has meant that they have to now become much more creative about what they do to be able to get the resources to be able to operate to accomplish what their mission. So one example of this up in Bellingham, Washington, where I'm from, we have an organization up there, a nonprofit organization called Resources. And Resources has done a wonderful job. You know, the original intent was to help with water and some of the natural resource issues, eliminating waste, and we're primarily grant and foundation based. Well, what they decided to do, because that was, you know, it's very, very tough to get into and very tough to get the amount of grants and resources they wanted to, is they basically went into business. They created what's called the Restore. And they actually have a Restore here in Seattle, and they have now and one up in Bellingham. And the Restore takes and resells, they take down old buildings and take the material, and then they resell the material. So they basically get donated used material in that they then sell to other people. So they basically are a nonprofit that are operating as a business. Okay, they have revenue coming in, they have expenses to pay for it, and they're using that difference between revenue and expenses, which in business terms is profit, they take and they use that to then help fund some of their mission-related activities. So they are solving mission-related activity by eliminating waste and promoting reuse, and they're able to use that to be able to provide funding that they can't get from foundations and other groups. So that is an example of kind of what's going on in the nonprofit sector. They're having to become much more creative about what they do. So a couple of more examples on social entrepreneurs, and again, both of these come from Bornstein's book on social entrepreneurs. A woman in India looked around, and in India there's a large number of orphans, you know, in the tens of millions of basically street children. People who don't have parents or who have left their parents and are basically live on the streets. She saw this as a significant problem. They had no resources. Government was doing nothing. Healthcare was doing nothing really to be able to meet the needs of these children. A lot of crime, a lot of health issues. You know, it was not a good situation. So she determined that the way to solve this is to establish a child's helpline. It's called Childline. And what they established was a 1-800 number that a child on the streets can call at any time, day or night, and this organization would be able to go out and help them. If they needed medical attention, they would go out, they would find the child, they would get him into health care, make sure they were appropriately taken care of. If they just simply had questions, whatever their needs were, they provided a hotline to be able to call in. This hotline was generally manned by children who used to live on the street, so they knew what was going on. It took a long time to be able to build up the trust with the children to be able to have them actually work with it, but it's over the last few years, it's become incredibly successful. It's now in most of the major cities in India. They're helping significant numbers of children. They've gone to the local telephone company and were able to convince them to provide them the hotline number for free. They were able to get some advertising to be able to let the street children know what was going, you know, about the line. And they've been able to be very successful finding a very creative solution to a problem that wasn't being addressed by the government or the social sector. Okay, so that's another example of social entrepreneur. A third one, Hungary. A woman there, her son was developmentally disabled. She struggled with that for a long time growing up, eventually cost her marriage. She was trying to figure out what to do. She would go and visit some of the state-sponsored institutions for developmentally disabled. What she basically saw is they were basically put in very sterile environments, sterile rooms. I mean, it was basically there was no interaction. There was nothing to try to integrate these children out into the mainstream community. They were basically just locked in a cell and left there to die, in effect. And she was not comfortable having that happen to her child. So she was trying to find a creative solution to solve this problem. Well, the first thing she did is she tried to get with a couple of other families that had children in a similar situation, and they established a co-op. And they would try to kind of work together as a small co-op to try to be able to work on ways to be able to integrate these children back into mainstream society. Give them a little bit more, words escaping me now, a way to be able to interact more, to be able to learn to deal with it and be able to overcome as much as possible these development disabilities. Well, started one, it failed. Started another one, it failed. So finally started a third one, kind of had the right people in there, and it was able to actually work pretty effectively. And from this, she was able to get a lot of confidence and has ultimately now been able to get where it's much larger. What she did from a funding standpoint, because funding is still very difficult, it was hard to get money from government, is what she's done is she set up businesses, and these developmentally disabled work on these businesses and they produce goods and services that they can then sell out to bring in revenue. Well, it accomplishes two things. One, it helps pay for this, and two, is it gives the children or the young adults an opportunity to be able to develop life skills. And she's got it set up now so they basically live on their own. You know, they do have a complex, but they have basically their own room. They have a job based upon, you know, what they're able to do from a development standpoint. And they're seeing people come into this and they're being able to exit and actually be able to go back and integrate into society. And they're providing the recreation, they're providing jobs, they're providing training, and they're providing funding for this. Again, another very creative solution to a problem that the Hungarian government had not developed or not devoted any time or resources or tried to figure out any way to solve it. She's been able to do this. And over the last few years now, she's been trying to figure out how to propagate these out to be able to do more of them. And it took many years, but now the government has finally recognized what she's doing and has recognized the value of it and is starting to help out a little bit more, certainly starting to advocate a lot more for that. So those are a couple of examples of what we're talking about from a social enterprise. So what you end up with is social enterprises or social entrepreneurs end up kind of crossing across the business, social, and government sector. They're basically hybrid organizations. They have some elements of for-profit businesses. They have some non-for-profit. They are hybrid organizations. They may evolve because of any one of those reasons. Okay? But they're setting up and coming with very unique and creative solutions. Now, from an academic standpoint, this is very interesting because, you know, does the traditional literature on business or nonprofit or government apply to these organizations? And the answer may very well be no, you know, which is why my dissertation is looking at leadership and culture. What sort of impact does leadership and culture have on these organizations? We've done a lot of research in the business sector. We kind of know that one, but these are very different. They're socially mission-driven. Their values may be different. You know, what are the differences? That's kind of the interesting part of the from a research standpoint. So Bornstein, in summary, basically said social entrepreneurs are transformative forces, people with new ideas to address major problems, people will not take no for an answer. One obsessive individual sees a problem, a new solution, and takes the initiative to act on it. They gather resources and build organizations to market that vision. They provide the energy, to overcome the inevitable resistance until a marginal idea has become a new norm. Okay, so you can kind of see these entrepreneurial traits flowing through it. You know, the tenacity, the passion, the new ideas. On trying to solve social environmental problems. Okay? Basically, they are change agents. So now let's talk about this from a water standpoint, because that's really, I think, why we're here today. Hopefully you can kind of take a look and imagine, you know, water, going back to the failures of business, the social and government sector, water issues are, you know, kind of cross all three of those. Okay, reason we're facing many of the water issues that we do is in large measure because of the failure of one of those three sectors to deliver. So from that standpoint, solving water issues is right for social entrepreneurship. And I think there's, in large measure, social entrepreneurship will have a dramatic impact on how many of these issues get solved. Now, I actually live up in Linden, Washington, just a couple of miles from the Canadian border, and water is a very significant issue for us. We live in a heavy agricultural area. There's a lot of raspberry farms, a lot of dairies. It is primarily an agricultural area. Well, we've got a couple of water issues. One is most of the farmers out there have no legal water rights. Basically, most of them are using water illegally. Everybody knows it. It's been going on for decades. As yet, there has never been able to find any sort of solution. You also have issues where, you know, despite as much rain as we get up there, we still have periods and areas where some areas water is extremely plentiful, and some areas there's no water at all. Okay, Linden right now, the city of Linden has a serious water issue. The growth in Linden has surpassed the amount of available water. Most of the farms there are struggling. So they're trying to find some creative solutions to be able to move water or figure out how to solve these water issues. Well, back in the early 1990s, a committee was established to deal with these. It was called the Bertrand Creek Irrigation District, or that's what it's called today. Originally, it was Henry Bierling and a few of the farmers said, hey, you know, this is a serious risk to us from an agriculture standpoint. We need to solve these issues. For a long time, they tried to do it through the government. They tried legislative fixes, and the state legislative would never figure out a solution to this. And still to this day, don't really have a good solution to it. So in the early 2000s, they decided to take matters into their own hands. They created an irrigation district. It was one of the first ones set up in the state. They got all the stakeholders to the table. They got farmers, they got the PUD, they got the Nooksack Indian Tribe and the Lummi Indian Tribe. All the key stakeholders they got around the table. They went out and figured out some creative procurement to get some funding to establish water flows. And they're now in the process of pursuing some strategies to access more water. And there's a couple of different ways of doing it. They're trying to figure out what's the most feasible. Henry Bierling, who has been kind of the key person or one of the key people through all this, they faced tremendous odds. Many times they could have easily walked away from this. They've had to demonstrate an immense amount of passion, tenacity. They've had to get educated on the issues. But over time, they've been able to make some they're starting to make some success. And they can kind of see now that, you know, within a few years, there actually might be some viable solutions. They set up an organization that was creative at the time. And certainly for that area, they've become a role model for other areas in the state. And they're now trying to do a few more in Whatcom County, and I believe they're setting up a few over on the eastern side of the state. So this is a local example of how you can use social entrepreneurship to be able to solve with some of the local water issues that we face. So from a challenges and next steps standpoint, and I'm going to divide this into two parts. One, from a practical standpoint. And because I'm actually interested in both. Actually, I'm probably more interested in the practical application than I am the academics. But to get a PhD, you have to do the academic side. So one is, how do you find these social entrepreneurs? Okay, if you look at the entrepreneurship literature, there's lots of debate and studies on entrepreneurs and how do you develop entrepreneurs and are you born an entrepreneur or can it be taught? Okay, well, we don't really know. But now we're taking those entrepreneurial traits and now we're trying to figure out, okay, so how do we find social entrepreneurs? So you got to find those people out there who have all of those traits, you know, the passion, the tenacity, the idea, the creativity, the leadership, all those things you need to be a good entrepreneur. Now you've got to combine a very strong social value system on top of that. Well, my guess is we have a lot of people in this room that probably fit that category. So how do you figure out who they are? How do you get them the necessary capital and resources and training to be able to go off and be able to solve these problems? You know, some of these, and a lot of these people probably work in large corporations, they work in nonprofit organizations, they work in our government, and they kind of are so fixed upon a certain model of doing things that they haven't quite taken a step back and said, hey, there are actually some other creative ways we could solve this problem. So you have to kind of do some mindset shifts and get people to start thinking differently. You got to take government people to realize, well, what if we actually ran this as a business, which is not something that they are accustomed to being able to do. So you got to figure out how to find them and help be able to get them to gather the resources, and in many cases, retrain them to be able to go out and set up these organizations and run them effectively. That is a challenge. And again, like I mentioned, there's a couple of organizations out there that are providing funding, Social Ventures Partners, Oshaka, there's a few others as well. But they're very small and very new. And we have to figure out a way, my own view is if we're going to get real serious about solving social and environmental issues, we're going to have to get much more serious about how we locate people and how we get them the necessary financial capital. Because right now we're pretty reliant upon some wealthy individuals and communities to be able to provide a few thousand dollars here or there. We got to get much more, we got to get much greater access to capital to be able to solve this and do it in such a way we actually are creating entrepreneurs. From an academic standpoint, there is a great need to move beyond kind of the definition stage into what really is different about these organizations. What sort of skills and training do they really need? What are the leadership and cultural differences? What are the values differences? And the idea here is to kind of use this academic to help to spur the practical side of it to be able to go out and solve them. The other thing, which I think is also very intriguing, is the opportunity to teach the concept in the classroom. Okay, a lot of universities now in the business program are teaching entrepreneurship. So they're giving students an access to entrepreneurship. A few of them are now taking that and actually have classes and stuff in social entrepreneurship. But again, it's a very small subset of universities. And in most of them, it may be one elective class or so. I mean, it's not probably going far enough to really get people, the students, so they understand the concept, are aware of it, and actually know how to do it. Because going out, starting a new business, writing a business plan, all these, gathering the resources, all these things are very hard, and people need the resources and the training to be able to do that. So that really is a challenge to the next steps. Now, from a water center standpoint, from the water, nobody really at this point is taking a look at how do we solve water issues through social entrepreneurship. So potentially it's stuff like establishing funds to help promote water-specific enterprises, kind of getting a water-specific focus on it would go a long way to help solving many of these challenges that we're facing. And I think with that, we're to questions and answers. So we got 10 minutes. Or we can all leave early if you don't want to have any questions.
When you talk about we need to identify social entrepreneurs that provide capital, who is we?
Good question. I think when I speak of we, I think it's society. How do we get government to start helping? How do we get academic institutions to start helping? How do we get the nonprofit sector? I mean, I think we have to collectively all work together to find these people, to find the social entrepreneurs. Because as I mentioned, I think some of them are actually sitting in our local state governments and federal governments. I think some of them are students right now at University of Washington or Western Washington or other higher academic institutions. I think some of them are sitting in nonprofits who are kind of set on doing a mission-related job and don't realize there may be some other creative ways to do it. So I think it's the we is a very collective we to help solve this.
I want to build on that question because it strikes me as I have the same sort of question that social entrepreneurship seems a sort of Darwinist kind of approach that you need the tenacity, you need the passion, and in part what you're describing is somebody who goes out and gets the resources, has the clarity of vision, and so providing those things in many ways is setting up potentially some people for failure in the sense that they may not actually have all of those traits and qualities necessary to succeed, and those who do are the ones who are more likely to do it regardless of the giving the resources, making it easy for them, I guess.
Right. And it's not something we know, right? Because we spend a lot of time on the entrepreneurship side with that same question, right? Is everybody entrepreneurs or are some people entrepreneurs? My own personal belief is I actually think in large measure you can teach entrepreneurship to some extent. Not everybody is going to be entrepreneurs. But conversely, I don't think we need everybody to be social entrepreneurs. What we need is enough of them who then can provide jobs and get the other skill sets that they need to be able to come up with the organizations that can go solve it. I mean, you need the kind of the person with the vision, that holds the vision, the passion, and tenacity, but they need lots of people around them to be able to help to execute that, because no entrepreneur ever accomplishes much on their own anyway. So I think there is plenty of space for everybody to participate in this, and it's figuring out what makes sense for people based upon what their interests are, what their values are, what their skill sets are, and where there are areas where we can help build their skill sets, which I think is very possible to do, because I did it at Intel. I know we can take people who don't seem entrepreneurial at all and make them very entrepreneurial. I think provide the skills when necessary as well.
When you talk about getting more funding to these people who are social entrepreneurs, are you yourself becoming a social entrepreneur for government and like other societies and families like that?
Yeah, in large measure, you know, the whole getting this set up is in large measure a socially entrepreneurial feat, right? And the key is structuring it in the right way to be able to make sure that we get the right answers at the end of the day. I would love nothing more, and you know, I actually have run for political office and probably will do it again. Because I have a vision of having either a local or a state government set aside some substantial resources that gets divided out between numerous organizations out there who can then use that to be able to develop social entrepreneurs. So I could see the state of Washington give a large chunk to some of the universities, social venture partners, individuals out there who want to help develop it. And let each of these groups try different things and try different ways of being able to create, provide the training, make different investments, and see how it works. I think that's a lot more productive use of our resources than some of the other things that we may use it on.
So to make changes in the societal level, do you think we should rely on policymakers, like for them to like choose policies that suits us all, or do you think it works better if we like basically educate individuals? And then, for example, I think it was Washington, I remember this fisheries club doing this club, something where they were having a website up for sustainable seafood practices, etc. So they're like just educating the public on going to restaurants that only sell seafood that is cooked in an environmentally friendly manner. And I think that way,
the question for those that may not have heard it, do we need to rely on public policy or do we need to rely on retraining or, you know, kind of how do you go about it? And I think the answer is you have to do everything. I mean, we have some very difficult social and environmental challenges out there. I don't think we can sit here and know how we're going to solve them today. I think we know the problems. I think most of the solutions I hear talked about, I can find lots of reasons why they probably won't work at the end of the day. So I think we have to be much more creative. I think part of it's going to have to come from public policy, but I also certainly hold a bias within me that if we wait for public policy to solve all these problems, we may all be dead before they get solved. So I think we have to be much more proactive as citizens and as social entrepreneurs and as individuals out there to try to start to find those creative solutions that will help.
I have a question going back to the chart when you combine the entrepreneurs with the social mission of equal the change agent. What I'm wondering about does this definitive split really exist between the social mission, people that support the social mission, those that are entrepreneurs, or can entrepreneurs be developed within the social mission itself? Within social organizations, the idea of the entrepreneur can actually come about through active participation instead of dividing it as a total separate addition to the whole equation.
I kind of have separated these out. I think in the real world, it's not anywhere near, I think it's more complex than that, right? We all bring our values and skills, however we get them, and you can look at psychology and sociology as the theories, how all that develops. I think in large measure, it's taking people who have strong social mission that also are willing to be entrepreneurs and either have those skill sets or are willing to develop those skill sets or are willing to kind of think about and do things differently than they have before. So I think the social mission piece of it is really important, but we do have to figure out how to bring out this entrepreneur part of them as well, because that's where the creativity, the innovative solutions come that will ultimately help solve the challenges that we face.
So do you believe that there's only a few people that can actually develop an entrepreneur trait, or can that come about through everyone participating within some kind of an organization that, like you said, we're supposed to kind of look for these traits in people and to teach them these traits? Do we really need to do that if collectively? It could pretty much come about as a natural process.
I'm not entirely convinced a natural process will get us there. I think there has to be some training. Like I said earlier, I don't think everybody has to be a social entrepreneur. I don't know how many people are out there. I actually think there's a lot more people than we may think there are. I think there's a lot of people who don't view themselves as social entrepreneurs that could easily get there. But again, I do feel strongly that there are, I think there are roles for everybody. And again, you need, you know, within any entrepreneurial firm, you do need that entrepreneur that kind of holds that vision, but you still need the marketing experts and the finance experts and the technical experts. And the social entrepreneurs are still going to, these organizations are still going to need the same thing, right? You're still going to need the person who is an expert on water public policy, and you're still going to need the business person who understands marketing. And all of those people are still going to need to exist. They just need, we need to find kind of some different ways to be able to organize these people so that we can get much more accomplished than we are today.
Thank you, Craig Mayberry, for a fascinating presentation.